This episode is sponsored by Environments for Humans, who do all kinds of cool online conferences. Check out the one coming up, Responsive Web Design Summit, at rwdsummit.com. Use the discount code NBSPTV for 20% off your ticket and go beyond Google searches and those incomplete, out-of-date online tutorials. Bring the experts to your desktop with the Responsive Web Design Summit, rwdsummit.com.
Hello and welcome to Non-Breaking Space, which you can find online at nonbreakingspace.tv. Non-Breaking Space is a show where we'll seek out the best, brightest, and smartest folks on the web and talk to them about how and why they do what they do. Your hosts are Christopher Schmidt and Dave McFarlane, two web designers, authors, and trainers who have a passion for sharing knowledge about the web. I'm Chris from Canada, web designer and podcaster. Christopher and Dave have invited along to help push the record button and keep everyone on track here on Non-Breaking Space. Our guest for this episode is Estelle Weil. Estelle started her professional life in architecture, then managed teen health programs. In 2000, she took the natural step of becoming a web standardista. She has consulted for Apple, Yahoo, and Kodak Gallery, among others. Estelle provides CSS3, HTML5, and JavaScript tutorials and detailed grids of browser support in her site at standardista.com. She is the author of Mobile HTML5 and HTML5 and CSS3 for the Real World. While not coding, she works in construction, dehippifying her 1960s throwback abode. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Christopher and Dave and their conversation with Estelle.
Thanks, Chris. Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Hi, Christopher. It's going well. Now, when we are seeking out the best and the brightest on the web, are we the best and the brightest, or are we just finding the best and the brightest?
We're finding it in order to become best and brightest ourselves.
We're kind of the mediocre, not so bright, and then we're finding the best and brightest?
I just see like we're trying.
Then how did I end up on this show?
Without any further ado, let's welcome Estelle. Hi, Estelle.
Hi, guys.
Thanks so much for being on the show.
Definitely.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Why don't we just start with you give a little history of yourself and how you got into this industry. I didn't know that you were started in architecture.
I did my undergrad in architecture and then got a master's in public health. So I taught, I did 3 years, basically I had one class left in architecture to graduate with a degree in architecture. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? Buildings are boring. I prefer interior design. Was doing a lot of public health because I'm not so young. And it was when HIV was rampant, but no one was talking about it yet. So I was doing like HIV education on my college campus, and everyone's like, that's a gay disease. It was way a long time ago. And I was doing the alcohol education policy and basically doing public health on my campus, but I didn't realize it was a profession. And then when I was trying to find a job in that field, they were like, you don't have enough life experience. I'm like, I need to become a drug addict to work in a drug facility. So I ended up getting my master's and then running teen health programs for 5 years. And when I discovered that computers didn't get pregnant, unlike my teens, I decided to switch careers. And, I loved what I was doing for the first few years, but afterwards, what I loved really doing was being on my computer. Mm-hmm. So realized you could get paid for being on the computer. And I've been doing web development ever since. So since 1999, pretty much 2000.
Cool. Wow. This is great. We talked to Ryan Ireland from Happy Cog earlier, and he has a master's in German literature. So it's
seems like
the path to web development is often quite circuitous. Most of our guests don't seem to have started in a technical environment in school or even after school. It took a while before they got into the web. Me too, including me.
Yeah, well, interestingly, my master's degree is in health and social behavior, and the social behavior has actually come in pretty handy.
Yes, I bet.
So it's been a fun ride.
So in what ways has it been handy?
The web, you either buy stuff or you find information or you interact socially. But even when you're finding information, it's how do you interact with the page. So I did a lot of studying human interaction. and human motivation when I was in graduate school, because it wasn't like, oh, use contraception. They're like, oh, yay, okay, sure. It was, how do you convince them that it's important for someone to do something? So I did a lot of studying, how do you convince someone that to do what you want them to do? And so in terms of, I'm not a UX designer, but I have a really good knack for UX. So it's actually been really helpful in pushing back when appropriate and helping guide designers who don't have much UX experience too. And then developing sites for clients, it's been really helpful.
Excellent. Well, you've got a lot of experience. You've written some books on mobile, HTML5 and CSS3, and you speak at a lot of conferences. Why don't we start with just talking a little bit about CSS3? And I think a lot of our guests probably, or a lot of our audience probably knows, you know, the basics of CSS. Do you have some things that you could share about CSS3 that maybe are new or upcoming or that people don't commonly know about?
I think what happens is people focus on the fun and exciting and don't go back to the basics. And the basics have really moved ahead. So mm-hmm. people are like, you know, people want me to teach animation and gradients right. And Flexbox. But I'm kind of like, do you guys know your selectors? And they're like, sure, we know our selectors. And they know three selectors. They know mm-hmm. the ID, the class, and the and element selectors. Right. But it's the basics that have really made CSS, you know, it's kind of a boring topic, but it's actually really exciting. You can pick any element on the page. So I do a selectors talk, and all of my talks are open source. They're online. They're available on my GitHub account, which is estelle.github.com. So there's a selectors talk there, and I go into like the nitty gritty of all the possible selectors. And you basically, you can target anything on your web page without hitting your content. So you don't have mm-hmm. to add a class or an ID to anything to target any element on your page. So whereas people don't think that's really exciting, to me that's mm-hmm. kind of the funnest part of CSS right. now. And then in terms of HTML5, everyone's like, yay, Canvas. And I'm kind of like, how many times are you going to put Canvas on your website? Whereas mm-hmm. how many right. times are you going to put a web form on your website? So web forms have become another boring topic, but they're really exciting. You know, there's placeholders. You can actually, instead of doing text input, you can actually talk into your browser. So you don't need to use a keyboard.
You can?
X WebKit speech on WebKit. Wow. Most people, you know, everyone's heard of Siri, mm-hmm. but Android's had a similar, you know, being able to talk to your device. Mm-hmm. for a long time. That's why there's the little microphone key on your keypad. Cool. So you just need to put an attribute for any WebKit-based browser, and you can not use the keypad. So that's really? Kind of exciting. Yep.
What's it? What's the attribute?
It's X. Right now, it's a WebKit only, so it's called X-WebKit-Speech.
And you put that like on an input tag?
Yep. And if you just look at in my GitHub account, there's a forms talk, and the last slide has it. So if you go to estelle.github.com/forms, and you go to the last slide, or maybe it's the last second to last slide, because the last slide might say thank you or something like mm-hmm. that. It just has an example, and you do have to be online because it does use. It goes online to get the dictionary to make sure that it's getting words correctly.
Okay, right. Cool. Well, let's talk about the selectors. So CSS3 selectors, why don't you talk about some of your favorite ones, some of the like less common ones that that you love because of their power?
I'm going to first talk about one that's well-supported, and it's not quite as exciting, but no one knows about it, and it's been around forever, which is the tilde. So most people know that if you do like UL space LI, it'll get the child of mm-hmm. an LI.
Right.
And if you do the greater than sign, that LI has to be the direct child of that UL. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people don't know the greater than sign, which is called a combinator. Then there's two other symbols. There's the plus sign and the tilde. So if you do UL greater than LI plus LI, it will be the LI that comes directly after the that LI. So it's it's the adjacent sibling. It is the next child. I mean, the next sibling. If you change that plus sign, which most people do know the plus sign, to a tilde, it means any LI that comes after it that's also a sibling. So it's an adjacent sibling selector. Oh, okay. So that's one of the ones where people are like, wow, I didn't know that. I'm like, yeah, it's been around since 2003. I don't know if it's 2003, but it's been around since at least 2005. Mm-hmm. Then some of my...
And is that supported in what, IE8 and up? Or
it's IE7. Let me just double check.
IE7.
Let me double check. I just crashed my browser, so it's going to take forever to check. So I'm not going to check. But if you go to standardista.com and then click on CSS3 and selectors, there's actually a grid of selector support. So you could tell me because you can get to my website faster than I can.
Right. So how about some other CSS? I'll look this up. Tell us about some other
CSS. So there's nth of type, an nth child. And nth last of type and nth. So you can say basically nth of type, and then you can put a parameter in there. And there's two key terms, there's even and odd. So if you want to stripe a table, you can just say nth of type odd, background color gray. And then every, if you put that on a TR, every odd table row would be gray. And then let's say you update the DOM or you sort. You don't have to add classes back in. It's there for you. And that's supported since IE9. Unfortunately, IE8 did not figure out how to do that. Right. And so those parameters that you can put through, the argument that you can pass through, you can use odd and even, or you can do like nth of type 3, and it'll just hit the third one. Or you could do nth of type 3n, and it would hit every third one. Or you could do nth of type 3n plus 8, and it would hit the 8th, the 11th, the 14th, the 17th, the 20th. And don't, I can't do math higher than 12. I only have 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Right.
So those are really powerful. And what's kind of interesting is you can actually do it. It's less performant because it first has to find the last one. But you can do it from the last of type. So you can do nth last of type 3n. So it starts from the bottom. Mm-hmm. And counts up 3. And what's really cool with the nth of type 1, nth last of type 3, is since you can put attributes, you can put selectors together, you can put more than one on an element, you can actually figure out how many elements you have using CSS alone. So instead of using like the DOM, JavaScript to count,
right?
If you want to, you know, if you decide that, let's say our layout is has just one LI, make that 100% wide. If it has two, let's make it 50% wide. If it has three, let's make it 33 1/3% wide.
Oh, nice.
You used to do that. Now you can do LI nth of type 3 colon LI nth last of type 1. So if it's the third and it's only three, then you make it 33%. So that's kind of like esoteric, and I don't know if the listeners can follow along because that's kind of confusing. But there's an example of that in my selectors talk if you want to go to my GitHub.
Oh, that's nice. Well, I think it's really cool if you want to do like responsive web design. You just need to have things be flexible.
Yeah, it's kind of a stopgap measure while Flexbox waits to be fully supported everywhere.
Yeah.
So the tilde selector is all the way back to IE7.
All right.
All right, cool. So I know that there's some advocates of like object-oriented CSS where it seems like, and I may be misinterpreting this, but a lot of people say, well, you shouldn't really rely on any structure of your HTML, which using selectors kind of how you're, some of these selector elements that you're, or selector types that you're suggesting really require knowledge of the structure of your HTML for them to work. So the OOCSS people are excited. Well, we'll just use classes on everything. decouple our design completely from the HTML. What do you think of that approach?
I've never looked that deeply into object-oriented CSS because my take, and I'm not saying this is for anyone else, but I already knew how to do layouts so fast that it's always been faster for me to hand code mm-hmm. than to use someone else's library. So I'm not mm-hmm. saying libraries are bad. I'm just saying I never found the need for them. Right. You know, because I have my own reset that I've been using, and I also do like the HTML5 boilerplate one. Mm-hmm. But I'm not saying there's anything wrong with them. It's just I haven't looked into Bootstrap or OOCSS. But I'm not sure if that's actually their argument, because when you say nth of type odd, mm-hmm. you don't need to know the structure of your HTML. You just need to know that you're going to have many of something.
Right, right.
And by saying that you're decoupling the HTML from your CSS, if you have to add classes on everything,
mm-hmm, yeah.
then you're not decoupling. On the contrary, you're requiring an understanding of what your HTML looks like because mm-hmm. you have to put classes on something. So with my thought is with these selectors, you really don't need to know what your exact layout is going to be because you don't need to know if you're going to have 27 rows or if mm-hmm. you're going to have 55.
Right.
But what's cool about these selectors is, you know, you just say, hey, if this navigation is in my aside, make it look this way. If it's not in my aside, make it look the default way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah.
So I'm not sure if that's conflicting with you. I would think it's in line with object-oriented CSS, but I can't tell you because I've never looked at object-oriented CSS.
Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about performance in CSS 3, because I know you've talked about that, and especially in the mobile space, I think you know quite a bit about that. Do you want to talk, could you explain a little bit about how well, first off, CSS 3 supported in the mobile world and any performance issues associated with CSS 3?
Well, it's the reason I talk a lot about performance and performance in mobile in particular is because most of the talk in performance has been dealing with input and output. How do you get the you know, the website onto the device? And that's really important, and that's a huge chunk of, you know, of what makes your compute your application not load. I mean, if you're not getting onto the device, if you have many HTTP requests, then it's going to take a long time to load. And that's not good because you don't want to have your user sitting there with a blank screen. But what people aren't thinking about, because it's really not an issue with desktop, is how long does a repaint and reflow take? And no one's been worrying about repaints. We've always been worrying about reflows because reflows are expensive. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to animation, repainting needs to be something we look at because you want something to update in 16 milliseconds or less, or else it becomes laggy when you're doing an animation. Because an animation is about 60 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
So if it takes longer to paint your screen than 16 milliseconds, your animation's not going to look good. Do you understand why? Does that make sense?
Sure. Why don't you tell us why?
Well, let me just reiterate it then. So like let's say you're making a snowflake fall from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
If your snowflake is, you know, this huge PNG that's 4 megabytes that takes the page 22 seconds to paint onto the page.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're animating it. So, you know, you're using transitions. So it's not even reflowing. It's just repainting is taking too long.
Mm-hmm, right, right.
And so it's going to be jumpy because it's not going to be able to repaint in time. And then another thing that you have to worry about with mobile is memory management. So let's say you have that radial gradient that uses up a lot of memory. And most people think a radial gradient is just two lines of CSS. And it is just two lines of CSS. It's really easy to write, but it takes up a lot of memory because the browser is painting every single pixel of that radial gradient. So if you do like a solid blue circle on a transparent background, that's easy enough because it doesn't have to measure what's behind it. It just does solid blue, solid colors. But if you are doing a transparency, it has to figure out, it has to calculate what the colors are going to be. So if you have multiple background images, it first draws the back, the last background image, the one on the bottom, and then draws what's on top of it, and then what's on top of that, and what's on top of that. Because they don't, you know, you, the browser doesn't know if there's going to be a transparent pixel, like 16 transparent pixels, one on top of the other.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It needs to know what that background pixel was in the first place. So when I was freelancing at Apple, I was sending all these transparent pixels that weren't even being seen. And I'm like, I thought I had an infinite loop in my JavaScript, and I debugged JavaScript one time for 6 hours because my browser on my desktop was crashing. And it was, in fact, I was animating an inset shadow on an element that in the end was never seen. So I talk about that example just so that I can save everyone else time. But people need to realize that if you're creating a radial gradient, like a linear gradient is pretty easy. It, it paints it and then repeats it.
Right.
So it's just drawing it once and then repeating it. If you're drawing a radial gradient and you're using for this corner, and you're, the center is in the other corner, well, it's that radial gradient is four times, it's more than four times the size of your screen.
Right, right.
And memory in mobile devices, you know, I have the, my original iPhone was 128, something like that. My, I actually, I don't know my current cell phone. My last one was pretty good at 768 megs, but I haven't had a phone that's over a gig.
Right.
And my computer has 16 gigs. Of RAM. So when I'm developing on desktop, I'm not seeing, I'm not having to worry about memory management. But if I'm on a phone, even if it has 1 gig, which none of my devices do, it's running the operating system on that. It's running the calendar. It's running the phone. It's running Facebook. It's running Twitter. All these applications that are giving me notifications are still running. Plus it's running the browser. And then on top of that, it's running your application, your web app. So that's what people, it's our job as developers to worry about these things because the user's not thinking about that. The user knows if they're like, that's another issue, battery. The user knows that they're using their GPS and the screen's on and the little lady is telling you to make a left in 300 yards, even though the... even though the turn is in 200 yards and you just missed it, they know that that's using up your battery.
Yeah.
But they don't think that your, you know, your Wikipedia is using up your battery or whatever. But when you're processing JavaScript, you're using up the CPU and the CPU is draining the battery.
So in terms of gradients, are you saying that if you have a radial gradient, the browser actually has to paint or at least calculate outside of the box that it's the background of, so it takes up more memory?
When you are, when you're, in most browsers, when you are developing, when you're presenting something in a mobile browser, and I assume it's desktop too, though I've never looked at the desktop, it paints the whole gradient because it doesn't know if you're going to animate that center of that gradient. It, you know, it doesn't know what you're going to do with it, so it, it puts the whole thing there. And, you know, when we're thinking about desktop or when we're thinking about input, output, and getting your website onto a device, whether it's a computer or a mobile device, we're thinking, oh, let's gzip. You know, let's gzip this video. It'll be tiny. We'll send it over the wires. What people aren't thinking is that when it gets to the other end, it expands back to its original size.
Right, right.
So that's using up memory. Similarly, when you're just drawing an image, like when you're using border image or when you're using gradients or SVG, you're thinking, oh, it's only these three lines of HTML, you know, of CSS, or in the case of SVG, it's 12 lines of, you know, of text. but the your browser is actually drawing that and sticking the whole thing in memory.
Right.
You know, it creates a bitmap out of it.
Yeah. So in terms of some concrete recommendations for mobile, and let's just start with gradients, would you say radial gradients you should be careful of because they will take up more memory and are more difficult to draw than a linear gradient?
What I tell people during my presentation is I never say don't use anything. You know, everything is there as a tool.
Right.
But you don't want to take a chainsaw to, you know, a toothpick. That was just the worst analogy I've ever come up with in my entire life.
I kind of liked it. It was very vivid. I still have it in my mind. There's no more toothpick left.
Right. There's no more toothpick. So what I'm saying is, you know, you can use radial gradients, but realize that they are memory hogs. Uh-huh. So if you're doing a tiny, like, little circle on a button, do a tiny little circle on a button. But when I hit the first time I tried a radial gradient on a you know, because obviously I'm going to screw up the first time I ever try anything. you know, there was just the designer had given me this tiny little curve at the top of the page. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely hate Photoshop, Fireworks, and any other image editing application. I just want to, like, for me, native CSS is the way to go. So I'm like, it was this tiny little curve. So it was like this 8,000, the radius of the circle was like 8,000 pixels. So mm-hmm. I create this 8,000 pixel radial gradient, which immediately crashed my browser. I mean, it wasn't even like, sorry, we're going to try to work. It's kind of like, nope, we're not doing this. Sorry. So that's, you know, that was a quick way to discover it, but not that many people are going to fail so, you know, so gloriously like me. Most people are going to put, you know, an 800 pixel gradient, which the browser can handle, mm-hmm. unlike my 8,000 pixel gradient. maybe your browser can handle 800, but you don't realize mm-hmm. that it's using up all this memory and not leaving room for much else.
Right.
So it's just, I try to tell people, you know, be wary of these things. Like, no one thinks there's another one that's, it's never going to crash your browser, but it is going to use up memory, which is mm-hmm. using small fonts. When you use a font that's really tiny, mm-hmm. you usually bring it up, you know, make it large. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know the name of any fonts because I'm not a graphic designer, but you'll bring a font up to 60 pixels because right. it'll make it look like it's 18 pixels. And it's actually drawing that whole thing. So you're using up, your line height is now 60 pixels instead of 14 pixels. And so it's as if it was drawing a picture that was 60 mm-hmm. pixels high. So you're mm-hmm. using up a little bit more memory. That itself is never going to crash your browser, but you're putting that with your 800 pixel gradient, radial gradient, and your inset, your animated inset shadow, and you're kind of screwed.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in general, gradients are safe to use in the mobile, for mobile devices, just you have to be cautious of certain right. things, of them being too big, taking up too much memory. How about animations? How are they in the mobile? Like, let's compare and contrast, you know, CSS animations versus, you know, JavaScript-based animations. Is there a performance difference between those two approaches to animating?
You always want to use CSS animations when you can, because JavaScript animations uses more CPU and drains the battery. Uh-huh. And because you're using JavaScript, animation is the lowest priority on the UI thread, and JavaScript, I believe, is the highest priority on the UI thread. So you know, animations, you usually want that as a background effect. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's not your main thing that you're doing on your website. Mm-hmm. You don't want to stop the user from being able to press a button. So if you're animating with JavaScript, then the UI is on hold. If you're animating with CSS, the UI is not on hold. And that's kind of an exaggeration, because when you're animating, it's really taking, you know, like 2 milliseconds or whatever. So you can probably still, when you do a set timeout, your button click will be able to get onto that UI thread. But your browser is developed, you know, animation is what the browser, CSS animation is what the browser is supposed to be doing, not animating with JavaScript. And generally, most people, when they animate with JavaScript, they're causing reflows. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah.
Right.
And usually when you're animating with CSS, you're not. It's just because that's how people usually tend to animate. You know, they'll animate with CSS, with JavaScript, they'll mm-hmm. change the height. So it'll have to reflow. When you animate with CSS, you're usually scaling. Mm-hmm. So it's just repeating. And you'll if you test both, you'll see that the performance and the battery usage of CSS animation is less than JavaScript uh-huh. animation. But I'm not saying yep. that JavaScript CSS animation doesn't drain battery. It depends what you're animating.
Right. Now, one of the limitations of CSS transitions, CSS animations is we have kind of a limited toolkit for triggering those. You know, we have basically these pseudo selectors like hover or focus. And hover doesn't really work in mobile, at least doesn't
I
seem
think
to.
I'm talking right. about transitions rather than animations.
Okay.
Because transitions, you usually, animations, there's a JavaScript API that actually goes along with it. There's an event when an animation ends and at every iteration right. and when mm-hmm. an animation begins. So right. I trigger all of my animations by just changing a class with JavaScript.
Okay.
So uh-huh. like when I said that animation is the lowest priority on the UI thread, let's say you're loading up a page and it has 27 different animations and they each start a second apart. So one starts at 0 seconds, one starts at 1 second, one starts at 2 seconds. Let's say your mobile page takes 8 seconds between downloading everything and the body onload event. So your first 8 animations had these delays that have already expired, but the animation hasn't started yet. So you're going to get your first 8 animations that are happening at the exact same time. So what I do is on load, I change the class name of the page to loaded, mm-hmm. and then I base the animations to start on loaded. And CSS provides us with animation play state of paused. So you either have animation play state of running or animation play state of paused. And so all you have to do is change the class from, change the property via class right. mm-hmm. from pause to running, and then you're good to go.
Right.
So that's one little snippet of JavaScript instead of 400 lines of JavaScript to get your animation running.
Right, great. So you use JavaScript, but mainly as a mechanism for triggering and controlling the animations, not for the actual animation, not the actual moving things across. Yeah.
When I was at Apple, I was working on a team of, we were 3 people, and we would do like the same thing because communication's not always the best, we're actually hitting the same thing. And my coworkers would end up with 500 lines of JavaScript, and I'd have 3 lines of JavaScript because right. I triggered everything. All I did was do class name change. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. everything else was CSS.
Right.
And then we ended up usually doing 75% of it my way and 25% of it their way, because I would do stupid stuff, like put a gradient that was 8,000 pixels wide.
right.
But the performance was, I was hitting a lot of performance issues and they were hitting a lot of performance issues, but my performance issues were easier to fix.
Uh-huh.
Like, I just thought, let's use a JPEG mm-hmm. sprite. Don't use a JPEG sprite. I mean, you can if it's small, but yeah. realize that if you're doing a background image for the full screen,
mm-hmm.
don't create a sprite out of that, because something that's 4 times as wide as your full screen,
mm-hmm. Right.
especially if you're dealing with high DPI, you've just shot the memory of your of your app. Because it is painting that whole thing in memory, and it's just showing part of it.
It is, really? Wow. Well, that's good to know. So does that mean, you should keep your sprites limited if at all when you're developing on mobile, or?
It's actually interesting. And there was just a discussion a few weeks ago whether sprites are better than individual images versus data URIs. And I don't know what the answer was, because I'm not the type of person that sits with the, like, that does tons and tons of testing. I'm right. more of an anecdotal performance mm-hmm. person than a tester. So I was interested in hearing what the solution was.
Yeah.
So like, let's say, you know, your Twitter app, you have like 5,000 people following you, and you're following 400 people, and those 400 people are retweeting each two other people. So that's tons and tons of avatars, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that Twitter could send you a sprite with the 20,000 avatars that you might get in a single day.
Right.
And there's not much of a way for them to know which, you know, if they do send you a sprite with the 20 that you need for this screen, they can't reuse that for the next screen, right? Because they don't know who's going to be, like, if you add 20 more mm-hmm. tweets,
right,
that sprite's no longer valid. So that would be a good place of using data URIs. You send a data URI with every tweet for that little avatar. Instead of, because you're already sending the JSON response of, I assume it's JSON, of what the tweet is, the time mm-hmm. and everything else, mm-hmm. just put the data URI. That way it's only one HTTP request for the next 20. Otherwise it would be 21, one for the text and then 20 for the each avatar.
Right.
So you're reducing the HTTP request by doing a data URI. But let's say you have, you know, 60 fave icons that you're using because you're doing a rating system and you're showing Travelocity rated this a 4, Yelp rated this a 3, Google rated this a 5, and you're going to be using that over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I think it makes sense to use a sprite for that
right.
rather than
yeah.
a data URI. Because it's still a small icon.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are Bing and you have, you know how Bing has a single background image for the whole page? If you're doing,
right,
you know,
yeah.
today it's a snowflake, tomorrow it's a mountain, the day after it's a stream,
mm-hmm.
those are huge images. You don't want a sprite for that.
Right,
so you
right.
just basically, there's in web development, you'll notice that there's many different ways of doing things. There's some things that are good ideas. There's something that are bad ideas. But there isn't much that's either right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's basically go for the good idea.
I like that. Yes. It's problem is finding that. Now,
yeah.
Talking about mobile and performance issues, are there other CSS-related performance issues that people need to look out for when it comes to mobile development?
I'm trying to think. I can't think today. Thinking's hard.
How about web fonts? Are web fonts an issue?
Oh, yeah. So I talked about web fonts in terms of the size. Another thing with web fonts is people, you know, they love web fonts. It's like, oh, this is beautiful. If you look at my blog, there's a web font for the word standardista. And if I were to, if I wanted, it's the only time I use the font.
Uh-huh, right.
So it's one word. It has, I think, 8 different letters in it. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Someone can count who was able to think today. So there's no reason for me to, you know, whether I show that website in the United States or France, Germany, or in Iran, or in Greece, or in China, it's still going to say standardista. I'm not never going to translate the word standardista into a different mm-hmm. language or character set.
Right.
So there's no reason for me if I want, but someone might look at it big and small.
Yeah.
So maybe I want different font sizes, but I don't need more than 8 characters. So if I'm going to include a font file just for that word, there's no reason for me to include more than 8 characters.
Right.
So I don't need to include the question mark. I don't need to include the A with a tilde on it. And I don't need to include the letter Q. So what's happening is people are like, oh, I want to send, you know, I really like this font because it has a really nice ampersand. Well, if you only use it for the ampersand, only include the ampersand.
Yeah.
And Font Squirrel, when you do the advanced settings, actually lets you to do custom subsetting. So you can pick one character or seven characters.
Right.
And then your font file will be tiny. And that's fine. You are doing the extra HTTP request. But if you needed that font, you needed that font.
And what about gzipping? Does that help at all? Or?
It helps you gzipping. Gzipping is really good for improving performance on input and output, setting things over the wires.
Mm-hmm.
But once it gets to your browser, it gets deflated. So it's still the original size. So when it comes to web fonts, you know, Arial already has every single character. It's like Times New Roman. It has like 10,000, and I'm making numbers. I'm pulling them out of my tushy. But it has like 10, it's like 10,000 characters. It right. shows simplified Chinese. It shows Hebrew. It shows whatever.
Right.
Use those if you can.
Right.
And if you just are doing your tagline, only include the characters, because you always have to realize that it's not just the extra HTTP request, but it's mm-hmm. the memory. If you're sending this huge font file to a device that has, you know, 2 gigs of storage available, not even, and 1/4 gig of RAM, not even available. Because my 768 megs of RAM device, with all of the day I turned it on, which meant I had not turned open any applications, it had 223 megs available. Because 0.5 gig was being used to run the device and the calendar and the phone and everything else. So always think of memory management and battery management.
Right. And you can use a service like Font Squirrel, they're at Font Face Generator, where you can just set the code, just the characters you want, and it will just give you those.
Right. So
most people just use Font Squirrel just to create the font files that they need, mm-hmm. but Font Squirrel does so much more. It's actually a really amazing little widget that they have there. Right. It does allow you to do custom subsetting.
Right. Well, so
if it's your tagline, just use the characters of your tagline. But if you have a huge presence in China, remember that you need to include the Chinese character set, not just the A through Z. But you know, there's no reason to include Wingdings. You know, like language, like Times New Roman. Wingdings is its own character set, but Times New Roman has things that I call Wingdings. They're not really Wingdings because that's a different font. But it has arrows, it has squares, it has circles, it has a smiley face. If you're not going to use that in any of your website, don't include that in your font file. Shrink your font file.
So in addition to the shrinking font files, is there also a with Retina images for for Retina displays and iris displays, that increases the image size, and so people are, one way method of dealing with that is to people are looking into making these really large images, but compressing the heck out of them, and squeezing them and stretching them out. Is there any memory performance issue hits with having, even though they're compressed in the really small files in comparison, is there an issue with having these really large images for a mobile delivery?
Christopher Schmidt, you probably know more about that than I do, because I know this is your baby, and it's not necessarily mine. But in my experience, I have sent, when you send something to an old Android device mm-hmm. versus a new iPhone that has high retina, high DPI,
mm-hmm.
it's 4 times the size.
Right.
So do you want to send the that 4 times the size image to the to my HTC? I now have a Galaxy, but I have no clue what I need to look at the specs of my Galaxy. The HTC Inspire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? The HTC Inspire actually has more memory than the iPhone 4 had. So, yeah, you could have.
Yeah.
No need to, but you could have, because the memory would have actually been able to handle it better. But but the thing is, when you're dealing with such high images, then or large images, you have to realize that it's harder to use sprites then, because your sprite is now 4 times the size as well. So what's interesting, it depends if you're animating it or not. So let's say you send this huge image over the wires. And so you're dealing with the memory of that, and you've compressed it so there's not much memory usage. But what happens is it takes, let's say, 12 milliseconds to paint, which 12 milliseconds is a long time if you're animating. But if you're, it's the background image of your Bing page, fine. You're not going to be changing your the background image. So the 12 seconds there is not an issue. You know, 12 milliseconds, rather, is not an issue. So you see, like, you have to weigh the pros and cons. But then if you're using background background size, so one of the new properties in CSS3, which is so vital when it comes to high DPIs, is the size of your background image. Because when you're sending a picture for a high DPI phone, it's actually four times the size of the viewport, and you need to squeeze it. So you need to tell it, you know, make it 320 by 480 or whatever. So you use background size. So it paints it once at full size in memory, basically, and then paints it at the new size. So it's taking 24 milliseconds to paint it, which seems like a long time, but if you're only doing it once, that's fine. You just can't animate it.
Right.
You see what I mean? Because like then animating it, it'll take 12 milliseconds to paint it every single time you animate it.
Right.
And that's where you're hitting a problem. So you really have to think of, I have this huge image. Is this a good idea or a bad idea? Well, if you're planning on animating a huge image, it's a bad idea. And by animating, if you're just fading in and fading out, whatever. But if you're moving it, that's a major issue.
Now, to switch gears a little bit, let's move to HTML5 because you have this book out, Mobile HTML5. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what is it in HTML5 that's so useful for mobile devices?
What's so cool with HTML5 and mobile devices is that all mobile devices that people are using to access stuff support HTML5.
Right.
So, yes, there's a lot of older devices that are out there, but those people aren't surfing the web in the United States with their Razer. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So what are, in particular, what are some of the most exciting HTML5 elements that are, you know, things that you think are great for mobile?
So let me go back to my favorite, which is HTML5 web forms, which you should be using right away. No need to wait because it's progressive enhancement. And so it makes your desktop forms wonderful as well as your mobile. But when it comes to input and output, you do want to reduce the times that you're hitting the server. And you also want to make, if you're doing a web application, you do want it to be available offline. So there's local storage, there's session storage, there's application cache. And while we wait for IndexedDB to be fully supported, most, like 99%, and I'm again pulling numbers out of my tushy, 99% of mobile websites that people use in the United States support WebSQL, because all WebKit browsers support WebSQL. The only two that don't are Firefox and IE10, I think. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go to Can I Use. Let me just go to Can I Use quickly. Saying something quickly is never fast on my computer. Okay, and it is WebSQL. So WebSQL works on Opera, iOS, Safari, the Android browser since forever, as well as BlackBerry browser. It just doesn't work on Opera Mini, but it's not expected to work on Opera Mini.
Right.
So WebSQL doesn't work in Firefox or IE, but as you know, well know, they don't have that much of the mobile browser market. So you can actually basically you have so let me just step back for our listeners. WebSQL has been deprecated, and it will never be fully supported, and it is no longer in the specifications. But it's unlikely to be pulled from the devices that have it, especially until, you know, all the computers are supporting IndexedDB, which means once we get rid of IE7, 8, and 9 completely. So I think WebSQL is going to be on these mobile devices for a long time. So that's really cool. But I am looking forward to IndexedDB, even though it's much more difficult spec to implement.
Yeah. And so that's who supports IndexedDB? Is there any devices that do that now?
IndexedDB in terms of mobile, with prefix BlackBerry 10.
How about on desktop?
On desktop, we're at Chrome, Firefox, and IE10. And it's actually unprefixed as well in those browsers. Uh-huh. But it's a convoluted syntax for me. I found WebSQL to be so easy. But then, of course, mm-hmm. I know SQL. So.
Right.
But Firefox, Mozilla was opposed to supporting it, and so was IE. And Mozilla was originally because it's a new language that people would have to learn. And I think IE was basically like, this is a proprietary software, and we're not going to use someone else's software or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what the argument was, but it was basically two browsers. If one browser says no, right. then it's never going to be fully supported. And, they were hoping to change Firefox's mind, but when IE said no too, then it was like, okay, forget it.
Yeah. So what are you working on these days?
I'm actually finishing that HTML5, mobile HTML5 book. I have 4 more chapters to write. So I'm hoping that'll come out in May. Uh-huh. And then after that, I am working on HTML5, the definitive guide.
Ah, excellent.
And I am doing a lot of... last year was a little bit crazy, so I'm hoping not to do as many. I did 37 talks last year. So I'm hoping to do fewer this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm only set up right now to do 8 between now and
February.
May. I haven't done any this year. I haven't done any in like 5 weeks. It's like withdrawals or something. I actually, after my last talk on the 17th, I like slept for 3 days. I'm like, it was everything for the year. It just finally hit me. Yeah. So I'm trying to do fewer talks this year, but I really like to travel. So if you want me to, you know, do a talk in Tahiti. I want to go to Barcelona, Greece, any of the islands, Thailand, India. If you live someplace where I'd like to travel to, please let me know. If you want to do a talk, me to do a talk in Nebraska, I'm don't so bother. Sorry, but I'm busy that weekend. Sorry, Nebraska, but you're the state I make fun of. And I've also been doing workshops. So I'm doing my CSS workshop actually next week in Austin. But I do this a workshop called CSS 3 from Novice to Ninja. And it's actually for people who think they're kind of close to being ninjas, and I show them that they're actually just novices.
It's an uplifting talk for everyone.
Yeah,
you learn a lot, but you realize how much there is to know.
Right.
It's, you know, it's kind of like those selectors. You thought you knew everything, and yeah. then you're like, oh my God, I didn't realize all these other things. And there's a lot of performance intertwined in that, and mobile, you know, concerns intertwined in that talk. So I was able to give that talk in that workshop in New Zealand, Hawaii, and Bath in the UK last year. So that is why talking is worthwhile, because you get to go to really cool places. but if, you know, if any of the listeners, if they have a business and they want me to come in and do the tutorial, that is kind of what I've been doing, and also still freelancing. I'm freelancing at SurveyMonkey at the moment, and have a few other clients, and writing and teaching and speaking.
Right.
And also there's another thing that I've been doing, which is I don't have one set up right now, but I do a series of workshops. Did a series of workshops. I did 3 full day workshops last year called Confident Coding. Oh. And it's kind of like the opposite of ninja coding or cowboy coding. There's a lot of people who are excellent developers and they don't realize that they are. So I do a session on stuff that people just assume that you need to know, or like people assume that you know, even though no one ever teaches you. So the first two workshops were full days JavaScript workshops, and people came in. I gave them stickers. If they were novices, medium, or advanced, they got red, which meant, you know, talk to me like I'm an idiot. Yellow, which meant, you know, I've programmed before, but I haven't programmed in a while. And green was like, oh, this is just a refresher course for me. And I'd say 70% of the people picked the red button. Mm-hmm. And I'd say 20% of the people who picked the red at the end of the day were like, oh, can I be a tutor next time? This was really easy. And I'm like, if this was really easy for you, then why is JavaScript not on your resume? Because we went from, you know, variable declaration to DOM manipulation in one day. So it was like a really speedy class, you know? And it was all vanilla JS. Mm-hmm. And they were like, I get this. I already knew this. You know, I already knew about variable hoisting. I'm like, if you know what variable hoisting means, you probably are better than a lot of JavaScript developers out there. It should be on your resume. And mostly it's to target, because there's people with imposter syndrome. So we end up having, 95% of the attendees end up being women. And it's just, you know, they don't associate themselves with ninja or cowboy, but they're just as good. They just don't promote themselves, and they, you know, the imposter syndrome. So it's overcoming imposter syndrome. And the third workshop we did was called Everything You Need to Know. So it was, we did Git, what the HTTP request lifecycle looks like, some command line, you know, like modifying your bash file so that you don't have to re-enter the same lines every single time, and introduction to performance. So it was all the things that, you know, no one ever told you about. Right. Like, no one ever told you that you can edit the bash file. Like, do you remember when you were told that you could edit your bash file?
I read it on a website somewhere.
you were fortunate enough to find that no one's talking about those anymore, right? Because it's something we already all know, except for no one knows it. So that's the type of workshop that we ran. It was just really empowering and really wonderful. And so I hope to do a few more this year, but the problem with them is they're also really exhausting to organize.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Please be thankful to everyone who organizes free community conferences, because, you know, I organized the conference, the first one, we sold out in 21 hours, and then someone goes, will you have vegetarian options for lunch? And I was like, lunch? Oh, no. So then, you know, I had to find sponsors. I found a space. You know, and I had the you know, and I'm like, oh, that's all I need is a space, a projector. It's like, no, you need snacks, you need lunch, you need vegetarian options, you need name tags, et cetera, et cetera. So you need sponsors. So I spent more time finding sponsors than I did on my deck, and which made my deck fairly entertaining.
Estelle, we have to wrap up because we're running out of time here, but it's been great talking to you. How can people find you on the web? Where are good places to follow your career and interests?
So I have my GitHub account, which everything that we've talked about here today is there, and that's at estelle.github.com. I am a woman engineer with a fairly unique name. So I got my own name, which is kind of awesome.
Awesome. That is awesome. Yeah.
And then Twitter, Estelle VW, like Volkswagen, though that's not really what it stands for, on Twitter. And please do follow me, because I am a Twitter whore. And and my blog is Standardista, and it's not really a blog. It's more of a resource. But this year, one of my goals is to make it a little bit more active and a bit more of a blog, where I share a little bit more of my day-to-day. And those are the three best places to find me.
Awesome. Well, it's been great having you on, and I've learned actually quite a bit about mobile development and CSS3. So thanks again for sharing your knowledge with us and with our audience. And
thanks,
we hope to talk to you again.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Our thanks to Estelle for joining us on Non-Breaking Space. As always, check out the show notes at nonbreakingspace.tv for all links and sites discussed during the episode. We're also in the iTunes podcast listing, and we'd really appreciate it if you subscribed, left a rating or a review. Helps us spread the word about the show. You can follow us on Twitter at SSKTN and facebook.com/SSKTN. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.